Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Monday, November 10th. Democrats in the Senate have broken ranks to move toward ending the government shutdown, but it's not a done deal. Air travel could still be curtailed further this week. We check in with the tourism expert. We hear from a witness to a law enforcement raid on Kauai, one of the largest in the islands to date, and the first time officials point to a link with a Venezuelan crime gang. And we take a closer look at the controversy around a proposed gondola project on Oahu's North Shore. And on this eve of Veterans Day, we salute the little-known World War II story of Old Glory and a Marine colonel prisoner of war. Plus, paving the way, we hear the story of the first woman from Hawaii to graduate from the U.S. Naval Academy. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. About 5,000 flights were canceled over the weekend nationwide as federal restrictions on flying came into effect. The Daniel K. Inouye International Airport is on the list of 40 high-traffic airports targeted for reductions by the Federal Aviation Administration. It's meant to deal with fatigue and staffing shortages among air traffic controllers who've been working without pay due to the ongoing government shutdown. Still no word on whether Hawaii will get an exemption for the flight restrictions, which are to ramp up to 6% tomorrow. State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen said he's trying to minimize the impact that fewer travelers will have on Hawaii's economy. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate has advanced a spending bill that would end the shutdown, with seven Democrats defecting. Hawaii Senators Brian Schatz and Mazie Hirono both voted no on the procedural vote, but there is still so much uncertainty tied to the cut in flights. This morning, we checked in with Keith Vieira, the former Starwood Resorts executive, now runs the tourism consulting firm KB & Associates. He was one of the founding board members on the original Hawaii Tourism Authority before it was folded under the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism. He spoke with us about how he's making sense of the chaos.
Well, the main thing is that Hawaii has always been affected by uncertainty. It's a pure leisure destination, nearly that much. And people are paying a lot of money to come here. So what they don't want to do is have risk of getting stuck in an airport, risk of having missed flights, the risk of maybe services where they're going not being what they'd like it to be. So when that happens, they're going to make a decision to either postpone coming to Hawaii or booking somewhere else that they view safer, easier, maybe a staycation or someplace they can drive to. In addition to that, we have been soft the second half of the year and going into next year, especially on the booking pace, and this is making it much worse.
Well, I was surprised because I was in the Waikiki area yesterday afternoon and chatted with a gal who was here from Seattle with her husband, and they'd been here 2 weeks. They were going to spend probably another week, and she said they decided to cut their vacation short to go back, that they wanted to make sure that, you know, they gave themselves some time to get a flight home. So I just found that very surprising.
Well, I mean, it's expected because it's one thing when you're going to come out here and if you get delayed a day, okay, well, you wasted a day of vacation. But if you're going back and you have to go to work tomorrow or the next day, you cannot take that risk that you may be stuck at an airport. Maybe it's here. Maybe it's a connection. So, again, that uncertainty will make people delay. Or, as you said, someone who's staying here will say, well, let's go home early just in case.
Yeah, we're talking money that this couple could be spending here locally, and they're just packing it up.
Yes, and then you add that to the fact that we've basically got no marketing dollars in the marketplace, and we certainly know the challenges out of Japan, Asia, China, and the visa program. So it really is a time to step up marketing in our key markets, which is obviously the West Coast, but also the big connection cities like Dallas, Atlanta, and even the East Coast going into the winter months. But because we have no money as a state in it, and in addition to what's going on now with the uncertainty, there certainly is a level of economic uncertainty. It's not just related to what's going on. you know, you add that to the century, which is really cancellation, really devastating Maui.
The golf tournament.
You still have recovery from the fires, and you add all of these things together, and then the fact that we're not marketing, it's understandable why we're doing so poorly.
The order to reduce airlift across the country, right? There's another round that kicks in, I believe, tomorrow. But how are you looking at, you know, a lot of these connecting flights or hubs as they're affected? You know, how do we get affected?
Well, I mean, naturally, somebody coming out, they don't have to come out here. This is not a business trip. You have to go to New York and for a meeting. This is for a vacation. So are you going to want to risk getting stuck in a connection airport? I mean, it could be a day. It could be a couple of days. And you've put deposits down on hotel rooms or whatever, wherever you're staying, and you just can't take that. So you're going to either postpone it or cancel it. And the worst case is someone books elsewhere because this is their vacation. You know, their vacation time is coming up and they can't just move it. So let's go to someplace simpler. This, again, adds to the uncertainty, and that hurts us the most.
Yeah, so the option of something closer to home impacts us. And then what about, let's say, visitors, you know, who come here to cruise or folks that are here for a convention coming up?
Well, the convention business would generally try to keep coming out. They would generally have done a group airfare out of certain cities, et cetera. So they definitely run the risk of being delayed, and they may make some changes, but I'm not aware of any groups that have canceled in this short period. But I am aware of groups that were looking at coming out either later this year or the first quarter that are delaying any type of decision making until they know more. Typically, group planners try to solidify all their bookings for next year before the end of this year. And there is a level of uncertainty going on, you know, that's added to some of them that were looking at the convention center and the major rooms there being closed. So it just adds to, again, more uncertainty is that should we book Hawaii now?
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about citywide conventions, right, you've got multiple properties that are tied into this event, and then they lose business, the restaurants in those hotels lose business just because the numbers could be down.
Yeah, and then, I mean, all of these things have a trickle-down effect. If the hotels or a restaurant is not as busy, they're going to close a restaurant or they're going to limit hours. That means people have less hours to work and make an income tied to tips, et cetera. That tends to hurt the small mom-and-pop restaurants, mom-and-pop surf instruction, other small businesses, because they can't cut back. It's just them and their family or maybe three or four workers. And so that's a significant impact for them. I mean, the hotels can always look at reducing expenses, at least to a certain point. But who really gets hurt by all of this are the drivers, are the taxi people, are the van people, et cetera, because they're going to feel these, not have seen, but feel these last-minute cancellations.
And we have seen the restaurants reduce their hours just because the volume's not there.
Well, look how many restaurants now close two nights a week. That was never the case before. So you just have people working five nights and you don't have to go to part-timers or shorter shift group. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that, not just in restaurants, but in activities and different options that are available for people. You're just going to see continued scale back, because even if this shutdown ends, it does take a little while to ramp up, back up, but you're still going to have the fact that our booking base looks terrible.
You know, I know that the Hawaii Tourism Authority is regrouping, and HTA is now under Hawaii Business and Economic Development Department. The structure is different. What are you hoping that HTA does as we navigate through this uncertainty?
Well, I'm hoping DBED understands that we have to get marketing again. And we're kind of trying to get a message of we need dedicated funding, and it should be 10% of the TAT. I mean, the fact that there's $1.2 billion coming into the state for TAT and we don't get any of it for marketing is ridiculous, because every dollar we spend will return 9 to 10 times that. So it's a good investment to help our economy. but I am hopeful that they cut a contract with the HVCB. There's no need for HTA to really be involved in the middle of it. I mean, I respect people that are trying to put their time and effort into helping, but dedicated funding, 10% to HVCB, and have a quota on visitor spending or tax revenues, whatever the goal should be, and then give them a three-year contract and get out of the way. Let them go do their job. The amount of interference is ridiculous.
Well, anything else you want to say about just this week as we navigate through this uncertainty?
Well, I mean, the real main challenge is, you know, after 9/11 and other big hurricanes, et cetera, you know, there was a real immediate pull together on how do we get a rebound and get people back working, et cetera. This prolonged downturn in this year, and a lot of this started with the pandemic, and then the Maui fires made it certainly significantly worse. And then you have all these other things happening along the way that exaggerates it, you know, such as we said, the current shutdown and the century, et cetera. We've got to get back to driving some business, because it's not like we're down 50%, but we're down 15 to 20. And that 15 to 20 means all these various operations. The last 20% is where you make your money. So they're either losing money or making no money, but having to make significant cuts. So it doesn't feel good. We need to get behind driving visitor spending again. And I'm hopeful that the legislature and the governor recognize it.
That was former Hawaii Tourism Authority board member Keith Vieira talking about the latest on the government shutdown and the impacts on Hawaii's visitor industry.
South Pacific soul meets Motown when musician Stephen Henderson and his band come to HPR this Saturday, November 15th. Join us for an evening of close, intimate, and raw storytelling from the Hawaii Island singer-songwriter.
Room is
Live from the Atherton Presents, Celebrate 808. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Agents with the FBI and Homeland Security investigation raided several locations across Kauai last Wednesday. The Department of Homeland Security said it arrested 44 people, including two suspected associates of the Tren de Aragua, a Venezuela crime organization. It's the first time that the gang has been linked to law enforcement operations here in Hawaii. County Council member Fern Holland lives across the street from where law enforcement agents showed up at one house at 4 a.m. She talked with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about what she saw and what she's learned in the days since.
So Wednesday morning about 3:45 or something, I thought I heard some sort of like low plane or helicopter. And that kind of woke me up. And as I was trying to go back to bed, the dogs next door really started barking a lot. And I looked out the louvers and saw a bunch of people walking in the street. And so I got up and I threw my dress on and walked out into the carport. And as I walked into the carport in the driveway, I realized that this was like armed officers. And there was a bunch of them, maybe a couple dozen, maybe up to 30 people total that were like present. And then they walked onto the property across from my house and surrounded the house. And then a bunch of vehicles pulled up and they opened up the loudspeaker and started reciting over and over the address of the property. And then just saying like federal warrant, come out with your hands up, executing federal warrant. And they kept saying that over and over. And then they did it in Spanish for a long time as well. Yeah, it was very loud in our quiet little street, but they were very clear that they were executing this federal warrant, and they were, you know, loud for a long time about it. And then I could kind of hear the officers. I pretty much immediately introduced myself as like, I'm, you know, a local county council member, and I'm just going to be standing here and observing. Basically, like, I was in the street from like 4 a.m. till about 12 noon that day. I basically heard them kind of saying some stuff back and forth. Like, this, they'd bring out one person and they'd be like, oh, this person's, you know, Filipino, speaks English. And then they would like interview each person. And it looked like they let go about half of the people that they interviewed. I think about half, they were in the correct status, or they obviously weren't who they were looking for or had a warrant for. And then there was other ones that they loaded up into these 15 passenger vans. And I think they ended up taking about 15 people off in the end, but some refused to come out. So after like the initial couple waves, one of the officers said, you're going to hear a loud explosion, like, to me. And then like a moment later, there was a very loud explosion. And then I think it was about 15 minutes or so later, there was a second one. And I think those were like flash grenades. Those were because certain people were barricaded inside. So it probably took a total of like over an hour and a half before they cleared the house of all of the people in there. And then many more hours where first they were like still going through people and then just going through the house. And they didn't end up leaving till about noon, the last wave of the officers that were there. And they had hit 5 different houses simultaneously about 4 in the morning.
Wow, that's a lot to see and be a part of. So that's what you saw and experienced in real time. Tell us a little bit about what you've learned since then in terms of what was going on. I know there are a lot of still outstanding questions, but tell us about what you have learned.
Yeah, I think the community has more questions than answers right now, because the statement that was released by the federal agencies was pretty short and didn't really have a lot of information in it. They said that, you know, 44 people were arrested. 2 of them may be suspected associated with that Venezuelan gang. You know, that's obviously very concerning if that's true and those people were potentially associated. I don't know what that means. I mean, to me, that could mean so many different things. That could mean that they have family members that are. That means that they could have once been. That means that they could have had tattoos that were from some point. That means they could be actively sending them money and engaging in gang activity. It's hard to know what that means. And I don't think we will know for some time about that. We do know, because of how small our community is and how much conversation's happening, a lot of people have been sharing a lot of things with me, and I haven't really been spreading and sharing that information because a lot of it I can't confirm. And so one of the things I've been the most concerned about through all this is just how rapid rumors were spreading and how quickly people were spreading fear through the community. And I understand that. I think without the clarity and without the information provided, people naturally like run to these ideas and rumors start. And so there was a lot of people thinking that there's still rumors that a lot of places that were also raided that were not raided. I've confirmed that, you know, no restaurants were raided in this. This was a very targeted operation, it appears. And all of the properties are owned by the same property owner, and all of the people arrested work for the same employment services company. And so we're piecing that together as a community. And as people start to ask questions and investigate, that looks like this is all associated with a single individual employment service and a person. And it's not random sweeps or even a collection of sweeps of just different people that they have. They're all workers within this place.
Absolutely. It sounds like a lot of unknowns there, but it also sounds like some clarity in that you understand it was individuals associated with one employer and not some randomized experience that was happening across the island and in different communities.
Right. It does seem that it was very targeted. They did have a federal warrant. By the afternoon, I ended up seeing the federal warrant. So I know that there was a federal signed by a judge for this large operation, which looks like it was probably a really long-standing operation or investigation, I should say, because they did hit a total of 6 locations, 5 houses, and then the office of this particular cleaning company or employment service company that does all kinds of contract workers, basically to hospitality jobs, from what I understand. I'm hoping that the community gets a little bit of reassurance and can take a sigh of relief that we now know what this big operation was. Because for such a small island and community, when we see that many federal agents and vehicles show up on our island, people rapidly spread rumors, and that fear again just spread really quickly through our community. And so I think there's a little bit of a sigh of relief that we understand now that this is why the federal agents were here, that they had this really big operation, and hopefully they got who they were looking for. And hopefully if these people are being trafficked, they're treated like the victims that they are and not the criminals that they're not.
Well, and it sounds like from how you've described things, it was exclusively a federal operation and there was not necessarily any involvement from local law enforcement. Do I have that correct?
Yes, there definitely wasn't. I communicated pretty quickly earlier in the week before the raids had happened with our chief of police and asked about the presence of the federal vehicles and the rumor that ICE was on island, because our community word spreads really fast. And within about an hour of those vehicles being on the docks, there people were calling me and people were concerned. And so as a council member, there's not really a lot that I can do. And I don't really have any authority to demand questions are answered from the federal government. But I can, within our council capacity, look at the county and what is the county doing? And are we playing a role in this? And our chief of police was not aware of the vehicles arriving. You know, our KPD officers were not included in this operation. And so our local police department really didn't have a role to play in this. This was an inner federal operation of many different agencies, law enforcement working together in a collaborative thing. But our local police department was not involved in that. And our mayor was not notified, and our council, we were not notified.
Any other details that you think would be important for our listeners to know and understand?
You know, for me, it's been very difficult to try to navigate this over the last few days. As a council member, it just so happens that one of these five houses is immediately across the street from where I've lived for over a decade. And, you know, it's been interesting. I've received a lot of criticisms on both sides of politics, people thinking that I was supposed to walk out into the street and stop some SWAT of 40 armed officers with a federal warrant to clear out the house across the street. And then other people that, you know, are really offended and feel like I've been protecting and defending people that are illegally here. And it's just a really politicized issue right now. And so one of the things that I've asked our community is to just really stop spreading misinformation and rumors and fear. From what I experienced, it was very loud and it was very traumatizing at 4 a.m. for anybody, I'm sure, that was in that situation and pulled out. But the officers were professional and nobody was hurt. I didn't see anybody tackled to the ground, or a lot of what we've seen in some of the videos that have been shared on social media about stuff happening on the continent. I think people expect that it may be played out like that here. And it didn't seem like that to me. And I was there and present the entire operation. They were wearing shirts that identified them as HSI for a lot of them. And then some of them had like FBI hats, and they were casually dressed though. They weren't dressed in uniform. And then a few of them had large law enforcement badges around their neck. For me, it's like, I am concerned about criminal activity in our communities, and I am concerned about the amount of fentanyl drugs and stuff moving around Kauai. It's one of the primary issues that my constituents talk to me about. And I'd say it's probably the number one issue we have on Kauai outside of like housing and affordability and keeping local families on Kauai. And so people really do want us to be targeting federal drug operations and possibly anything related to gang activity that includes drugs or criminal activity in our communities, we want addressed. But if only two of those people were maybe suspected to have those associations, then a lot of those people might be victims of trafficking, which is also very concerning to me, right? So I want to make sure all those people get due process, and I want to make sure that our rights and the liberties that this country was founded on are respected all the way through the process, and that those people are given, treated humanely and have dignity in the way that their case is presented, get the opportunity for fair trial and whatever they're entitled to. And at the same time, I want our law enforcement to ensure that we are taking criminals and potential gang associates out of our community. So it's a very difficult, I found myself in a very difficult situation trying to navigate this. And I feel like no matter what I do, both sides are going to be mad at me on how I respond about what I saw and felt.
That was Kauai County Council Member Fern Holland talking about what she witnessed with the recent federal law enforcement operations on Kauai. The fate of a controversial gondola project on Oahu's North Shore rests with the city's Department of Planning and Permitting. The Honolulu City Council last week passed a resolution asking DPP to pull the permit. That, along with opposition to the project by 8 neighborhood boards, is part of the pushback. Here with the story is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this is a pretty contentious issue.
It is a very contentious issue, but this is actually the first, at least not the first, one of the few times we've seen various facets of the community are actually on the same side, even if that side is actually in opposition of a project. You look at controversial projects like the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea and the Kahuku wind turbines. There is obviously clear divide on those who are for and against those projects. But for this one in particular, you see the U.S. Army garrison in Hawaii also oppose the project, citing concerns about public safety issues because the gondola is a little bit too close to the military practices. You have environmentalists who are raising concerns about the cutback of native forests and the impacts of native species as well. And then you have residents in the community who are citing concerns about the lack of public input. And they also cited concerns about increased traffic and over-tourism in the North Shore neighborhood. And I spoke with conflict resolution expert Peter Adler, and he says it's very rare to see nearly everyone on the same page when it comes to controversial projects like this.
My impression is this is a profound difference of opinion about values about a place. And we've seen this before on the North Shore. There's been a lot of other controversies around Turtle Bay and around the designation of marine protected areas on the North Shore. So I'm not surprised by it. It's not surprising. This one seems, it's interesting that so many unlikely groups have become allies, at least at this moment, in the opposition. So it'll go back to DPP, it sounds like, and they will consider taking it up again. They could reject it, just say, we've made our decision and that's that. They could review it again. So they'll look at it in terms of the law. What is the law? What are the legal pieces of it? And what are the factual issues that are at play? I mean, that's what they have to do. If this was a negotiation, which I'm not suggesting, then there could be a lot of room for people to talk a little bit about some of the technical issues. One of the processes some of my colleagues and I have used, and we used it on the GMO issue on Kauai, was really what we called kind of a mediated joint fact-finding. We got everybody to really sit down and walk through the assertions and the defenses and say, what's the evidence? You know, if you say pesticides produced by the GMOs are killing sea urchins offshore, show us the evidence. So it's a joint process. But I'm not sure that that's relevant here. It's going to go back to DPP, and that's going to be their job.
And so the issue here really, though, is this a project that is more tourism-driven or ag-driven, right? Because that land is ag.
Yeah. And so from the developer's point of stance, it's more for kind of more of like attraction and for ag land. But to the residents' point of view, they're thinking it's more over tourism because it's not just a gondola project. It's actually a zip line as well. And that's what caught residents off guard. And so this project is called the Kamana Nui Agribusiness Project. And so the developer, they want to attract daily visitors for sightseeing and cultural education on the slopes of Mount Ka'ala, which some residents say is considered sacred. And the property is managed by Kau Konohua Ranch, who received a conditional use permit in 2019. This is the following year after they went to the North Shore Neighborhood Board for the first time presenting their idea. They initially bought the property from Dole Food Company in 2017. But after they got the conditional use permit, the community felt that they were caught off guard. And Kathleen Pahinui, who is the chair of the neighborhood board, said that was pretty sneaky of them.
Lack of communication with the community was first of all. They came once in 2018, promised to come back and work with the community, and then the next thing we hear, about a year or so later, they've already put in a conditional use minor permit. And I was up there at the top of the mountain with them that January before they put it in. So they knew they were doing this and they never said a word to us. So that was number one. It felt very sneaky, I guess is the word I'm looking for, you know, not transparent. And then it had things in there that it was kind of different from what they were talking about, nature trails and stuff. Suddenly we have gondolas and zip lines and, you know, 1,500 people and you know, they wanted to do night events and weddings. And someone was like, what? This isn't how they portrayed it. They portrayed it as something that was very passive and non-mechanized and et cetera, et cetera. And then they, you know, had this huge ag component because it's ag land and you're supposed to use ag land for agriculture. And it felt like, whoa, this is not ag-based anymore. This is tourism-based.
Yeah, bait and switch, I guess, from where she sits.
Yeah, and the only individual who opposed it was actually the ranch, and the ranch said that they have scaled back on the project a little bit more, but they are waiting on the fate of this project in DPP's hands, which DPP said that they will make their decision on the permit by the end of this month.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll know something soon, but thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
That was HR's Cassie Ordonio. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Hey, Yo-Yo, did you know that your cello can talk to whales?
I wish.
Yo-Yo's cello is going to be connected to a speaker. If we're lucky, we'll pick up some humpback whale song.
I'm Ana Gonzalez, and I've been traveling around this country with Yo-Yo Ma for the past few years. In Hawaii, we went out on a boat with scientists and musicians.
I think my job was whale chantress.
To communicate through space and time with humpback whales. Listen to Our Common Nature from WNYC wherever you get podcasts.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
There will be no 21-gun salutes or military flyovers on Veterans Day on Oahu. The traditional veterans ceremonies that take place at Punch Bowl and the state veterans cemeteries are canceled tomorrow because of the government shutdown. There will, however, be a small ceremony at the Oahu Veterans Center in Foster Village to acknowledge the sacrifices of our men and women in the military. Today we bring you a couple of veteran stories in advance of the commemoration of the service and sacrifice of our armed forces. Veterans Day has special meaning for a University of Hawaii scientist who we have featured on The Conversation before. The book Captive of the Rising Sun includes the story of Patrick Cross's grandfather, who was taken prisoner of war during the invasion of Guam during World War II. There were hardships that came with being in two different POW camps in Japan over 4 years, and there were emotions around the lowering and raising of the American flag that still remain for the Cross family. Cross talked about the moments that live on through his grandfather's own words.
So my grandfather, Major Donald Spicer, was the executive officer, or the XO, of the Marine Detachment on Guam when the Japanese attacked at the beginning of the war. So after a valiant but brief fight, they had to surrender. And he personally was at gunpoint forced to lower the American flag at the governor's palace in Guam, which had been their headquarters for the U.S. presence there in Guam. So he became a prisoner of war for the rest of the war, the entire war in Japan. But the emotional part of the story is that flag that they lowered at in Guam, they were able to keep to themselves and keep hidden and under clothes or whatever, but hang on to it through the war, through all the miseries of the prison camps. And ultimately, my grandfather was able to, he requested and was granted the right to raise the American flag at Rokuroshi, which was the Japanese prison camp where he ended his war experience, although most of his time was spent at another camp called Zentsuji in another part of Japan.
And you were able to travel to Japan to go connect with that part of your family's history?
Yes. Interestingly, my son now lives in Japan, with his Japanese wife in the Kobe, Osaka area. So we made a little day trip down to Zensuji. It's just a few hours away. And there's actually still a modern-day Japanese Self-Defense Force base that's located there on the site of the where the prison camp had been. So yeah, we were able to visit. They have a little museum there that commemorates the World War II era. And there's some pictures of prisoners of war and stuff in books in their little back room. And we were welcomed quite enthusiastically by the curator, I guess you'd call her, of the museum. So yeah, that was really kind of emotional to be back on that site.
You mentioned that he was forced to take that flag down, and I guess they had kept hidden secret this symbol, right, this flag. And I understand that there is a book that was published. It was an account from an admiral about being in those prisoner of war camps, and it mentions your grandfather. And when I was reading it the other night, I was so surprised to see that they had his words included as part of this book about what it was like being forced to take the flag down and then raising it once they knew that the Americans came back. And so I'm going to ask you to read that, if you could.
Sure, yeah.
The book is called...
The book is called Captive of the Rising Sun. It's written by Don Giles Jr., who is the son of Don Giles Sr., who had been on Guam. He was the number two naval officer. He had requested the honor of raising that flag. And so here's what he said about that. He said, "And there, 45 months after I tasted the bitter dregs of humiliation, almost 4 years after I became the first U.S. Marine to strike our colors to an enemy, I was to raise the first American flag over the Japanese homeland. My feelings, therefore, as I reverently held the flag in my hands and proudly marched up the hill to the flagpole on September 2nd, 1945, are not difficult to imagine. With a final caress, I let that grand old flag slip through my fingers to flutter proudly over the Japanese homeland. As I gazed upward and saluted the stars and stripes, I swallowed hard, restraining my tears. After we were dismissed, I let them flow freely, laughing and crying at the same time as we milled about, wringing each other's hands. Every man was filled with the same surging emotions. Every man was holding on with his last ounce of strength, determined to prove that he came from fighting stock, which could not be beaten." That's it.
You know, it's so important to keep these stories alive. I was reading that I think one of the last social things that they had on the island was they were watching a football game, Army versus Navy. And of course, they were rooting for the Navy, and the Navy won. You just take for granted those kinds of things and the stories that bring it all back about what happened during the war and the attack. And so as you observe Veterans Day, I don't know, what do you want to convey to our listeners?
Oh, I'm a veteran myself, and so was my father, and we have an extended family history of service in the Marine Corps and in the Navy, primarily, with some Army guys back in the day as well. So Veterans Day always means a lot to me from a family perspective, but just as an American, it's, you know, service to our country has always meant a lot to me, and I particularly honor Veterans Day and Memorial Day for that reason, but obviously many of us Americans do.
I have to thank you for turning me onto this book because it does detail an account of my home island during the war and giving me context because I think of the war because of the attack on Pearl Harbor and the many stories that I've done with veterans, but then to get a glimpse of what it was like on that island because around the time that Hawaii was getting bombed, so was Guam. When you read his account of how that all came down, I'm very grateful to have the printed word and to see it from that point of view.
I think the key difference between Guam and Hawaii was that Guam was bombed around the same time as Hawaii, within hours It was December 8th due to the dateline, but obviously what happened a couple days later was actual invasion of Guam by Japanese forces on land, which many thought in Hawaii would happen here as well. Unfortunately, it did not. But what the local people of Guam went through was pretty horrific. Yeah. And I think one of the things that comes out in this book and other accounts I've read is what a tight bond there was between the U.S. forces and the Chamorro people, or the people of Guam in general. I visited Guam a few times myself, and I visited the governor's palace. And I don't know, I have an inherent fondness for the Chamorro people because of what they went through together.
Yeah, and in this time and space, there is a buildup of the island just because of what's going on politically in the Indo-Pacific area. But it certainly is important to just stop and reflect on the many people whose lives were lost and whose lives were changed because of that war. So I certainly appreciate you bringing this book to my attention and the history that I didn't know.
Yes, you've inspired me to reread the book because some of the details are already getting fuzzy for me.
Anything else that you just want to share just about how things have changed?
Gosh, obviously things have changed pretty dramatically between the United States and Japan. They're among our best friends in the world. And I don't know. Geopolitically, there's obviously been night and day change for the better, obviously.
After learning your grandfather's story, like I said, I was so intrigued because these are stories you don't always hear about. There's so many stories, but when December 7th rolls around, right, we have the last veterans that make it over here pushing 100. So you always stop and think, but it's just amazing, like I said, piecing together that history.
There's not too many of them left, but I don't know. I think whether you had a relative who was taken prisoner or not, I did, but most did not. I think it's worth reading these sorts of accounts of what people went through at the hands of the Japanese, not to dig up old angers or anything, just to understand what people went through so we hopefully don't repeat those sorts of those things again. Yeah, that story has meant a lot to me through my life. I wish I could have known my grandfather. He died just after I was born. I didn't get to know him. He did rise to the rank of colonel in the Marine Corps before retiring and unfortunately died in 1960.
That was retired Navy man Patrick Cross, who was sharing his grandfather's experience as a Marine POW during World War II on Guam on this eve of Veterans Day. Don't go away. We will highlight one of a Hawaii woman's story and her experience paving the way for others in the Navy.
Housing is getting so expensive that in a lot of places, the workers a city needs to run can't afford to live where their jobs are. So some places are turning housing into a job benefit.
We are invested in having our employees be part of the fabric of this county, and we had to think of a way to be able to get them here.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Many veterans say getting out of the service was a tough adjustment. That's because the community that gave them a sense of shared purpose often disappears when they leave the military. This Veterans Day, join us for a special broadcast of Conversations with Veterans, where we'll hear from some who found connection and purpose in surprising places. That's tomorrow at 11 on HPR One.
Rear Admiral Alma Mi'oi Laugraki is the first woman from Hawaii to graduate from the United States Naval Academy. She is a member of only the second Coed class. Rocky is featured in a one-hour PBS special honoring our nation's veterans that airs today. The conversations Maddie Bender spoke with Rocky about how growing up in Hawaii prepared her for the Academy.
I thought it was really funny that you joined JROTC to boost your grade point average when you're over at Punahou. But tell us about those early days.
Well, I had no dreams or talk about being in the military. My dad worked at Pearl Harbor Shipyard, so I did have some connection to the Navy. When I was a kid, I attended public school at Kapalama and used to walk to school because I lived in Kalihi, was born and raised there. And I used to go to the shipyard with him and just sort of hang out in the summer because they didn't have all the gates and badges and everything. I used to say, "Dad, what do you do at work?" And he said, "I answer phones and go to meetings." I'm like, no, what do you really do? And then when I went with him, I found out that is actually what he did. He went to meetings and answered phones. So I got a look at the shipyard and all these guys walking around, and they were experts in what they did, and they knew how to fix the ships and the submarines, and it was so amazing to me. But still, no real thinking about being in the military. But then in fourth grade, I ended up at Punahou, and then in high school, joined Junior ROTC. Like you said, I joined it to raise my grade point average, but it was a pretty good organization, really a lot of great people. And I learned a lot as far as some discipline and processes and procedures. And then my parents said, "Hey, we afforded Punahou, so if you want to go to college, you better find a scholarship." So I started looking around, and a classmate told me about the Naval Academy because all his dad, his grandfather, his uncles, his cousins had all gone. He told me about it, and I looked into it and said, "Oh, here's a way to get a degree and a job for 5 years afterwards." And so that's what I did.
Yeah, and you were the first woman from Hawaii to attend the Naval Academy.
Yes.
They didn't even have uniforms for women at the time.
Well, they had uniforms because I was in the second class of women there. So when the first class of women arrived, they had uniforms, but they were sort of men's uniforms modified. So the white jumpers that you're used to seeing enlisted sailors in, we used those for PE and our first year as a plebe and in the plebe summer. And what they did is, because men or boys don't have hips like women do, they put maternity panels in the side. They just sort of cut them open and put maternity panels. And that was really fashionable. They decided that bras are, brassieres are one size fits all, right? So they would just issue them and you got what you got, And same with the first class of women, we had to run everywhere we went. And so they figured, well, you're women, you wear pumps. And so they gave the women pumps to run in. And of course, everybody got shin splints. So by the time I got there, they had solved the problem with the pumps. But funny enough, you notice a military uniform has a straight line between the edge of the shirt, the edge of the buckle, and the edge of the fly on the pants. Well, they got really smart. They issued us men's shirts, which they were smaller, even medium, they fit. But they tailored our trousers for us. So you didn't have that smooth line because men's shirts button left over right, and women's trousers have a fly that goes right over left. So you didn't have that line, and they didn't know what to expect. In an inspection, they asked about that. Why does your uniform not line up? So there were some things that it was a learning curve, and you had to have a sense of humor about it. It was actually pretty hilarious.
Yeah, it seems like that's something you really maintained throughout your time at Naval Academy and beyond, just a sense of humor. But were you ever nervous, or what did you think? I mean, going into this situation, not only one of the only women there, but one of the only non-white people.
Coming from Hawaii, I think was a huge advantage. I didn't really think much about race or culture. I mean, of course, we have our culture here and our special food that nobody knows what it is, but I wasn't really looking. I knew three swear words. I couldn't understand dirty jokes. Totally sheltered, totally naive. I showed up the day before because I was a rifle shooter with my rifle to check into the armory. And I showed up in a muumuu with Lay's. Walked right up into the main office with my rifle and said, "I need to check this into the armory." And the guys were so helpful. And after they helped me do that, I offered them all Lay's. And they said, "Oh, we can't wear that with our uniform." And, "Oh, okay." Totally clueless. But I think in some ways it was really good. I was 17, right out of high school, coming from Hawaii, where cultures are blurred here, colors of skin, girls, boys, everything's blurred. I wasn't looking to be prejudiced against. I wasn't looking to be dissed. I wasn't looking for situations where I should be offended. And I didn't even realize all of that until many, many years later, talking to my two roommates who'd gone through just about everything I had gone through. They were both 21 when they got there. And they recalled incidences that we all shared completely different. They had a real different spin on it. You know, they were more worldly, I guess, than I was. And they saw where people really were not as friendly or as helping or welcoming as I had seen it. But I totally missed a lot of that. And I attribute that a lot to coming from Hawaii and sort of our aloha spirit and helping everybody out and not really looking for bad things. And I don't think they were, but they saw more of the things I did not see.
Did you feel pressure at all, you know, just being exceptional in all ways and not letting them see you sweat?
Well, we did have a talk. Like I said, I was in the second class of women, and some of the women in the first class, there were none in my company. So we were the first in our company, but they did say, don't forget that what you do, what you say, how you present yourself, how you conduct yourself, that's going to be the foundation for how people view women, women in the military, women at the academies for the next years coming in here. So just be aware of that when you say something, when you do something, just be aware of how you're being viewed or how it could be viewed. They told us that, but I was still very clueless. Sure, fine, whatever. And I think one of the things I noticed was that the guys who had sisters could care less whether we're there, what we're doing. They were used to having girls around them, women around them, and so they didn't really care. It was the guys that didn't have sisters, were only children or something, or had all brothers, that had a more difficult time relating to us. And, you know, in some ways, it was difficult, I think, for them. When the decision was made to integrate women into the academies, there were so many things that happened quickly. It wasn't always a thoughtful process. And so in many ways, the male midshipmen suffered because, you know, they were told they didn't have enough money for a coach, for a sport. 20 years, it were club team, volunteer coaches, all this. Then the women come in with Title IX and boom, you know, we have 15 teams with paid coaches. And so I think a lot of that was difficult for them. They didn't get much briefing on how they should act or what they should do. So there were guys that were very, very strict with the women because they didn't want us to get away with anything, which is fine. And then there were guys that were probably too lenient because they didn't want to be accused of being prejudiced. And so you kind of ran the gamut. And like I said, you had to have a good sense of humor. You had to keep your emotion off your face. You had to just sort of roll with everything. And again, you know, the easygoing nature we have in Hawaii, I think that really helped. That and being clueless like I was really, really helped to get me through the rough patches, I think, at the academy.
That was retired Rear Admiral Almalau Grocki talking to HVR's Maddie Bender. Head to our website to hear more of their conversation, including what life was like for Grocki after the academy and her experience working with her father at Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard. The PBS special Salute to Service premieres today on air and can be streamed at pbs.org. Well, that's a wrap for our show today. Tomorrow, we'll have special programming in place for Veterans Day, The Price Paid for Liberty. We will see you back on Wednesday. Do you have a Veterans Day story to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find the conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We will be back on Wednesday with more of the conversation.